This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Child Catchers and Trench Bulls, portrayals of abuse in children's fiction.
Now, this week has the potential to be a little heavy.
Yeah, we don't pick easy topics, do we?
We don't, but we're going to try and, you know, tread this line quite carefully. And we're going to obviously treat it with the respect that it deserves, but... Yeah, we're not gonna be going full in.
Yeah, our intention is not to completely delve into the topic and turn it into a workshop, because that's not really what we're here for. But we thought it would be interesting to look at how it's portrayed in particularly middle grade children's fiction, so older junior fiction and younger junior fiction, but not young adult, nothing above that.
Yeah,
and see how that actually resonates with children and with adults, because there's quite an interesting dichotomy there.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And the interesting thing is that, as I said, we're not looking at YA. Obviously, you get, you know, this examination of toxic relationships in YA and things like that. But there is this very long tradition. That sounds wrong, but there is a long tradition of abuse in middle grade fiction. And interestingly enough, when you say that, people are like, really? Is there? I mean, yeah, you have the examples of like the evil kind of stepmother sort of thing, and you wonder how much of it has come from fairy tales, because they certainly have influenced middle grade fiction. But I think probably before we kind of delve into this, we should sort of examine what we mean by abuse.
Yeah, we should have a broad working definition, I think.
Yeah.
Now, I actually worked as a child protection officer for the Goju-Ryu Karate Union of Great Britain for about 5 or 6 years, and I won't go into my role too much, but one thing we did have to do was be able to identify the main types of child abuse, so I feel relatively confident addressing this. And I probably should do, having done that for so long. So technically, you might find the NSPCC website will say that there's 4 main types of abuse, or, you know, mistreatment. Mistreatment is the term they prefer to use now, I think, but we always called it abuse. Actually, a couple of them have subsections, so I would still classify it with the old 6 classifications, and there is a 7th floating one as well, so I'll just run through them quickly. There is sexual abuse, which obviously we're not going to go into today because it is too huge a topic, so we're barely even going to touch on it. It's just too big, we couldn't do it justice, but, you know, we're acknowledging it's there. Physical abuse, so beating, mm-hmm. hitting, that sort of thing. Psychological abuse, generally this involves manipulation, gaslighting, tearing down a child's confidence, humiliation, that sort of thing. Neglect. Mm-hmm. Which should speak for itself. Emotional abuse, some of that feeds into the psychological, but basically children have a right to expect their caregivers to, if not cherish them, at least respect them. So anything that falls short of that is emotionally abusive, whether it's intentional or not. Mm-hmm. And then there's Munchausen via proxy, which I think is outside the scope of the episode. But this tends to happen between a mother who is not terribly well mentally herself, and a mm-hmm. child, and having illnesses projected onto the child so that the child actually starts to think, you know, the child is in harmony with the mother and will start to act at the mother's insistence as though they are ill, and start to believe themselves ill because the mother says so, because the mother enjoys having the attention given to her by having a very sick child. It's quite twisted. It does an awful lot of damage to the child. Again, I think it's slightly outside our scope of this episode, but we're acknowledging it's there.
Yeah.
And the 7th floating one is the child-on-child abuse, which we would typically call bullying.
Mm.
So, again, we might touch on that one.
Yeah, and I think it is important to to touch. As I said, we've got a lot to talk about, so so we're going to have to be quite selective. But yes, I think that a lot of people don't recognise child-on-child abuse and the impact that it can have. And I think it's important to recognise it as abuse, and to, because I think if we say, oh, bullying, everyone gets bullied, you know, and you kind of, you lessen it. But there are severe and important cases. And bullying is something that you see a lot of in middle grade fiction.
Yeah, absolutely. It's worth saying at this point that sometimes people who, I think the trouble is the word abuse has become synonymous with the word paedophile in some respects. So when you say abuse in this context with child abuse, and even child-on-child abuse, people automatically assume there's a very dark sexual component. And there isn't necessarily, in the same way that abuser may be unintentional. Maybe they're sick themselves. Maybe they are suffering from abuse from somebody else and they're passing it on. That mm-hmm. doesn't excuse it.
No.
But it's not quite the same as somebody who is intentionally setting out to harm somebody else because that is how they make sense of the universe. And yeah. Okay, that's a very generous term that I've used there because I have opinions there and I'm not going to go into them. We do not have the space for it.
Gasp! Jules, you have opinions?
I have opinions. I know, you probably haven't noticed over the last 150 so episodes, but I thought it was time to really be out there with that. So yes, a lot of this stuff is, you know, is too big to go into more than just with reference to fiction and how it helps people or doesn't or harms in those cases.
Mm.
So we're not saying that everyone who has ever engaged in abuse, because most children at some point have inadvertently bullied or participated in bullying someone else.
Yeah.
So we're not saying you're a hopeless lost cause because but it is worth saying, let's look at behaviour that's damaging and let's all take a step back from there and see how it's reflected in fiction.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Anyway, now, the big problem seems to be that, or the one I hear most often, is that a lot of adults find that representation of abuse in children's fiction to be cartoonish. So if you think of Roald Dahl, Miss Trunchbull, the headmistress in Matilda, and in the book specifically, what she does is so extreme and out there, people are sort of like, well, it's like Tom and Jerry, isn't it? It doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
And the same with sort of perhaps the early Harry Potter books. I've heard this said, you know, making him live in a cupboard under the stairs, making it so obvious that he's not wanted.
Yeah.
And yes, they have a point, but what they're forgetting is they're looking at it from an adult perspective with all the nuances that age and adulthood have given them.
Mm-hmm.
It's different when you're a child. When you're a child, something like that is huge. It fills the entire universe because your universe is tiny as a child. You don't have experiences to fill it with.
Yeah.
So setting it in a cartoonish way, and often in a fantasy setting, means that it's accessible for the child to safely look at it, take it apart, and see it for what it is, and then reflect it against their own experiences. It's really important it's done that way.
Mm. Yeah, I think you're right. And it actually, as you say, it provokes a deeper kind of thought in that, you know, you might assume that it's just lazy writing. And I don't think it's that at all. It's about provoking a reaction. It's about also creating very clear characters who can still be very nuanced. And, you know, a lot of depth. I mean, Miss Trunchbull, Matilda, it's quite black and white. And I think another thing to recognise is, of course, that when we talk about middle grade does actually cover quite a large area, in that you have lower middle grade and you have upper middle grade. You know, you have 9 to 11 and then you have 11 to 14. And the development which is happening during that period of time is phenomenal. You know, these are kids who are going from, you know, being prepubescent to entering the first stages of being teenagers. So there's a lot that is going on in middle grade. And so it's only natural that you're going to have this variety, but it's still within a certain spectrum which calls for these kinds of characters and for them to be quite obvious in some ways, even whilst being quite three-dimensional and subtle in others.
Yeah, and I think what makes it particularly interesting is at the point at which harm is done in these situations in books, and Miss Trunchbull's a really good example of that, in the sense that what she does is extreme. She picks up a girl by her pigtails, whirls her around like a hammer, like she's throwing the hammer, and chucks her over the fence. And I remember reading that. I was 10 when the book came out, and I got given the hardback at Christmas, which just goes to show how mad I was about the books back then. Because you did not get a hardback book. You waited till the paperback came out.
Of course.
Because it was more sense. Anyway, and I remember reading it, and the utter horror of it happening, and the recognition I felt at the time that an adult was an all-powerful being as far as I was concerned, even as a 10-year-old. I didn't think they were always right, but at the same time, they were in charge. And we are naturally disposed to want to defer to somebody who is in charge, like a child does for an adult.
Yeah.
You have to be really pushed to go against your initial programming, I think, to turn around and say, no, you're absolutely wrong. I mean, it's ingrained in us from the start that we are polite and respectful to adults, unless all adults have treated us badly, in which case then you tend to go down a completely different route.
Yeah. So I think the other really important thing to recognise here is that not only was Miss Trunchbull in a position of power as an adult, she was actually physically in a position of power in the physical sense. She was big, but she was also the headmistress of the school.
Yeah.
You know, and that, you know, we have this illusion when we're kids that there are certain people who have all of the power and who can do things without consequence. You know, the belief that my parents could solve anything, you know, that there were things they could do and there would be no consequences because they were powerful adults in positions of power. Of course, as we get older, we recognize consequence. We look at Miss Trunchbull and just go, hold on a second. If she'd grabbed a girl by the pigtails, first of all, she'd have ripped out her hair. And even if she didn't do that, you know, she'd be arrested straight away. There's no way that this would be allowed to happen. And we say it's very cartoonish. But as a kid, It's totally plausible, actually.
Yeah, that's exactly, it feeds into that child psychology of they can do anything, and the fact that they're willing to go that extra mile and make it something really, really out there, really outre, makes it, nobody's going to believe you. And that sense of nobody is going to believe me as a child is a very crushing one. When you first get that particular feeling over anything, over someone bullying you at school, over a teacher humiliating you in class for no reason or no reason that you understand. It's that, you know, I have that there's no consequences for them. I know where my place in the universe is now, and it's not what I thought it was. It entirely shakes your sense of self.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is that, you know, you can talk about Miss Trunchbull being cartoonish, but there was actually also a narrative that was going on about there, which said that adults aren't always right, and that they don't always have the power, because you have Miss Honey, and she's a teacher, so again, she's in a position of authority, but she's still in the control, you know, she has an abusive parental figure in the form of Miss Trunchbull, and she's stuck with her. And she can't get away from her. Yeah. And despite the fact that Miss Honey is this, you know, this very caring person, she's not able to prevent what happens in the classroom.
No.
And I think it's really important to recognise that you may have this very cartoonish kind of action, but this is an action that feels feasible, but is to the extreme. So I know, for instance, that as a kid, I knew, for instance, that my headmaster could get away with anything, but I relied on the fact that he wouldn't do certain things like that because he had a certain level of standard. And the whole point of Miss Trunchbull is, I can get away with anything, and I'm going to get away with anything. But then to also parallel that with a character who is still within that caregiving role, but who's ultimately weaker in their position, in their physicality, in every sense of the word. I think it was very important that Roald Dahl actually recognised that abuse is something which can occur into adulthood as well, and the effects of it can continue
Adulthood. Yeah, definitely. I mean, obviously Miss Trunchbull controls all her money and where she can live and everything. And I think Miss Honey even talks very briefly about how difficult it was for her to leave home, as in she snuck out. She snuck out with a few clothes and a suitcase.
Yeah.
The fact that she then ended up teaching at the same school is kind of bizarre if you're looking at it from a logical plot perspective.
Yeah.
But at the same time, does also kind of make a lot of sense because she wants to help other children. She just doesn't know how, and she can't really help herself. And then you have the other set of abusive parents, or parent figures, which is Matilda's parents, who just really don't pay any attention to her, except her father, when he does pay attention to her, is usually shouting at her, telling her she's stupid, ripping up her books and things, because she doesn't fit into what he thinks she should be like in the family.
Yeah. And I think there's another very interesting thing about Matilda, which is actually the ultimate message. And the ultimate message is adults can be wrong, which is not something you actually tend to see in a lot of fiction until very recently, which is that even if people mean well for you, they can be wrong. And we started to see it in things like Moana and Coco, you know, saying adults, they can be wrong and there can be compromises. But the other very interesting thing is the fact that the happy ever after for Matilda is that she lives with Miss Honey.
Yeah.
And usually there is this very strong message of family is the most important thing. You know, we misuse the saying, blood is thicker than water. Of course, it's actually blood of the covenant is thicker than water of the womb. So it's actually the complete opposite of what you're trying to say. But, you know, we use this blood is thicker of water. Family is everything. Family is the most important thing. And Roald Dahl actually gives a very important message there about saying that actually the family that might be right for you isn't necessarily the one which you were born to, and blood isn't actually the strongest indication. The happiest family at the end of that is Matilda and Miss Honey, who've both come from abusive backgrounds and have both kind of come out kinder because of it. And interestingly enough, the dynamic is also quite different, because Miss Honey is a lot gentler, whereas Matilda is really the one who pushes for change. She's very much not in charge, but you know, she has a lot of her own agency, and she's the one who kind of influences Miss Honey to do the right thing, and to get away. So she saves Miss Honey rather than the other way around.
Yeah, I mean, it was quite a revolutionary thing to put in a middle grade children's book, and at the time it would have been aimed for sort of, I don't know, 9 to 11 year olds, and now it's filed for the 6 to 9 year olds, so you know, things change. But it's the fact that Matilda actually starts a campaign of retribution against her parents as well.
Yeah,
so she starts very early on with her great intelligence, which is obviously a big asset for her and helps her process why she's being treated like this and come to a logical conclusion. And her logical conclusion is, well, I can't get out, so I'll get even. And it's kind of delightful to watch. I mean, by all accounts, Roald Dahl was a thoroughly unpleasant man who didn't like children, and the book would not have been what it was without his editor.
Yeah.
However, the book that we got, which is what we're judging, does actually say an awful lot in quite a short space of time. And I, you know, I still think it's a valuable piece of children's fiction.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the other thing to remember is that there is an implication of almost kind of murder as well.
Yeah.
In the book that Miss Trunchbull killed Miss Honey's parents.
Well, yeah, no, I love that, because it's Matilda's kind of like, well, you're willing to do this, so presumably you're willing to do that. I'm going to go out on a limb and say you did it. And it looks like she might actually be right.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, but it is a really, you know, it's a very interesting dynamic. And I do like that message of saying that of what family actually really means and what it is to be family. Because oddly enough, this message of family is the most important thing can actually be quite toxic. Now, I just want to, you know, take an aside here and say that there's two sides of this argument. On the one side, I think that there has been this popularization of annoying family dynamics.
Yeah.
And you kind of get this, oh, the moody teenager, and you're almost expected to not get on with your parents. And I think there's also this element of parents sometimes don't take the time to get to know their kids, or don't take the time to kind of engage with what they're interested in, and vice versa. And there is a kind of a culture which separates young people from adults, which is ultimately actually kind of unhealthy. And so on the one side, I want to turn around whenever I see kids having needless arguments with their parents and just say, don't waste any time being angry. Don't waste time arguing about stuff like that. Try and find a middle ground. And if maybe you just you're just in a bad mood or it's hormones or something like that, which is totally valid. But if that's the case, just take a breather. Walk away and then come back to it when you're calmer, because as you know, someone who's lost a family member, one of the biggest things for me has been, you know, the things I had to contend with was thinking, God, how much time did I waste over something which ultimately wasn't important, and being angry over things that didn't really matter. And those are big regrets for me. So on the one side, I am, you know, fully behind that blood is important, family is important. And if you can, and it's not just down to the kids, that's the important thing, it's down to parents as well. But if you can sort it out, you should. On the other side of things, there are definitely kids out there who would be better off without their parents, or would be better off with some separation from their parents, or having another form of authority or caregiver. And I think this message that no, you should stick with them just because they're blood is very harmful and very dangerous. And it's unfortunately something which kind of has been pushed in children's fiction a lot, the importance of family. And it's why I think this conversation about abuse, particularly in children's fiction, is so important.
Yeah, definitely. It adds context to something that may or may not already be going on, even if it's just at a level of we don't really understand each other, or I'm passing on what I learned from my parents to my kids without realizing it.
Yeah.
So finding an outlet in fiction and seeing yourself there, or seeing a situation similar there, but mm-hmm. in a context where you can remove yourself from the situation, is extremely important.
Yeah.
I'm just going to touch briefly on James and the Giant Peach, because I think you're onto something with the family.
Yeah.
But it, if you remember James and the Giant Peach, James is orphaned because his parents are killed by a runaway rhinoceros, which escaped from London Zoo. So you start off with the classic cartoonishness of Roald Dahl.
Yeah.
And then he's left with his two aunts, Aunt Sponge and Aunt Spiker, and they're potentially made quite comedy figures. I don't know if you've ever looked at a paperback copy of the book, and they may well have changed it now, but the original paperback copy of James and the Giant Peach that I was given as a child, I think I was about 7, was not illustrated by Quentin Blake, who does all those wonderful semi-stick characters.
Yeah.
It was done by a slightly different illustrator, one that made it a lot more realistic. And you could see how terrified and ashamed and alone James was in the pictures. So even if you weren't getting it from the words, you were getting it from the pictures. Mm. And it, that book has always sort of haunted the back of my mind. Despite, again, the cartoonish Roald Dahl descriptions, it's always seemed a much darker book, possibly because of those illustrations, but the way he's treated, it is a campaign of willful neglect, because they do not want to take him in. And
no.
He has everything that was his taken away from him. He's taken away from the home he knew and he loved. He loses all his toys and books and possessions. He's turned into basically a servant. They won't let him associate with other children. He has no outlet whatsoever. And then the weird magic with Peach happens, and he makes friends with all these insects, which to start with seem quite unlikely, and some of them even frighten him, particularly the spider. And then they go on this amazing, improbable but wonderful adventure, and they become family through shared experiences. So once again, you have that theme of family's what matters, but it's almost like the family that loves and cherishes you, that you choose, is the one that matters.
Yeah. I think there is also a very interesting, you know, metaphor there, which is that if you are put in a situation whereby the life, human-sized insects are the more preferable company... then there's an issue. There's a situation there which needs to be addressed.
Definitely.
Because in theory, that is terrifying. It's really
well, it
scary.
Is, there's a glow bug and a spider and a giant earthworm and ladybird. And
a ladybird, yeah. And I tell you what, I love the film of it.
It's been a long time, but yeah.
I think the film managed to capture something really, really about it, because I did read the book a long time ago, but the film captured the big sides of things, and it was entertainment, it was bright and colourful, but actually the way they did colour was very interesting, because of course. During his time when he's with his aunts, everything is very black and white.
Yeah. It's how it comes across in the book as well, with the old illustrations I was talking about.
Yeah, it feels very sapped of life and chance and goodness. And, you know, even when they have, in the film, you know, they've got people lining up to kind of see this big peach, but you see... James being kind of pushed away from that, and everything is framed in a very kind of scary, very cold way. And then, of course, everything completely changes with the magic glowworms. And even James himself physically changes when he arrives, because he becomes cartoonish when he's within the peach. He changes. And suddenly there is this, which is, it's hilarious, because of course they're inside a peach, so I don't know how it's lit. and like, there's the great potential for that to be disgusting. But it's these warm, because it's a peach, it's this warm yellow, these warm colours constantly, and these very dynamic figures. And there's a softness as well, because of the animation style. Everything feels very soft, and it's just wonderful. They really, really managed to capture that homely kind of feel and the genuine terror. And also they capture the trauma of what happened to James in a really brilliant way, because they kind of put the rhinoceros in the sky.
Yeah.
With the clouds. And I loved that. I really, really loved the way that was all animated, because that storminess, it was terrifying. It was really scary. And it kind of took away the cartoonishness of it. This became a real antagonistic figure that you kind of understand has a presence the whole way through his story, because his parents were killed. And I just think that it adds so many different layers to the dynamic. It's just brilliant. And it's actually a story which possesses a lot of depth, if you look at it that way.
Okay, I'm going to move us on briefly to Tangled before we look at one which I'm sure everybody knows is coming. First of all, Tangled.
Tangled.
What Tangled does that's really interesting, and yes, it does sidestep the fact that it's not an actual parent that's doing the abusing, but to all intents and purposes, Rapunzel is kidnapped as a baby, and she believes that Gretel is actually her mother.
Yeah.
And she's locked up in a tower, which, you know, if anyone who knows this fairy tale of Rapunzel knows that there's a slight deviation there, but basically that's fairly true to form. Mm-hmm. And But the way they do it in the film that's really interesting, someone really knew their shit there. Because Gretel gaslights Rapunzel when she Rapunzel gets to 18 and starts thinking, I want to see the outside world, I can't live my life in the tower. And of course she has this magic hair and Gretel wants to keep her for herself and does not want Rapunzel going out. And you can see in that one song, Mother Knows Best, that Gretel has engaged in this deliberate, systemic and sustained emotional abuse in the form of manipulation and gaslighting. It's every little line in that song, things like, I know you think you can look after yourself, but actually you're immature, you're clumsy, you're putting on a bit of weight. She pretty much gets everything in there. It's the sort of thing that I sometimes hear teenagers saying, well, you know, my mum says such and such. And I'm thinking, my God, there are actually parents out there who do treat their children like this. And they don't, the kids don't realise that you're being manipulated. You're being emotionally and psychologically abused.
Yeah.
You can't see it. And then I hear one of them will have seen something like Tangled, where it's done so well by someone who really understands what they're doing. And they're like, oh my God, this is what's happening to me. Because it's a terrible cycle to try and break out of when someone's got that sort of hold on you. I mean, do you remember the bit when she's outside the tower and she goes from euphoric to really depressed to euphoric to depressed?
Yeah, I think, as you say, there have been so many people who've come forward and said how well it was represented. And I think there's a certain level that you understand how well it's represented, because watching it, we recognise that she's abusing Rapunzel. But there's still this kind of quiet voice that says, but she loves Rapunzel, and she doesn't. Or if she does, she's not being a good caregiver. And maybe there is love there. Maybe she does love Rapunzel to a certain degree. And there are certain messages which are shown to say, look, she does love Rapunzel. You know, the way she holds Rapunzel, the fact that she says, okay, I'll go out of my way, you know, on this long trip to get you a special treat and stuff like that. And you're like, these are all signs of love. Except she's doing that to stop Rapunzel from asking to leave. She touch starves Rapunzel in a lot of ways, and the only kind of the only physical affection that Rapunzel really gets from her is all mixed in with the abuse. And it's all about the hair as well. And someone made an interesting observation, which is that every time she says, I love you, Rapunzel, she's touching Rapunzel's hair.
Yeah.
Or she kisses her on the hair, or things like that. And it frames it in such a good way that actually shows, even if there is some form of love there, it's not healthy. And Rapunzel is being abused. And the only time she figures it out is when an outside perspective comes in and says, this is not right.
Yeah, I mean, deliberately withholding affection from a child is a form of emotional and psychological abuse, and can be a form of neglect as well.
Yeah.
And the very deliberate way that Mother Gretel does it in the film is, as you say, so she's touch-starved. So when Rapunzel sort of defies her a little bit, she's like, oh, make me the monster.
Yeah.
Turns it around on her, a classic gaslighting technique, as in, I only care about you, and look what you've done kind of thing. Look what you're doing to me.
Yeah.
And which is why she has that massive mood swing when she finally gets out of the tower, between, oh my God, I'm out here, this is where I want to be. Oh my God, I'm a terrible person, I'm a terrible daughter, my mother's going to be heartbroken.
Yeah, because Mother, she's turned it on her constantly that Rapunzel is the one at fault.
Yeah.
Whenever anything bad has happened, or whenever Rapunzel feels bad, by the saying, oh, I'm a monster, you know, this is classic manipulation. And the other thing is that another form of manipulation is that she then gives Rapunzel a certain amount of freedom whilst saying, you are going to fail, and sets her up to fail.
Yeah.
In that Rapunzel wasn't going to fail. She was going to return the, you know, the tiara to Flynn or Eugene, and he'd fallen in love with her. He wasn't going to leave her, but she frames it in such a way that Rapunzel feels she has failed, so that the only time Rapunzel gets what she wants and she fails, the message very clearly is Mother was right.
Yeah,
Mother does know best.
It's one of the most pernicious forms of abuse is to actually withhold your affection from somebody, telling them that you're doing it for their own good and that it's because you love them, and then tell them that nobody else will ever care about them like you do.
Yeah.
Because they'd learn not to value themselves, and they never really expect anybody to love or value them.
Yeah, and I think that's the important thing, is that, you know, it all comes down to that, to being touch-starved, to being starved of affection, which is that you can have this warmth, this thing which you need, but only if you do what I want you to do.
Yeah.
And it's about using, affection as a bargaining chip, which is just...
It's disgusting. It's really disgusting. Appalling.
Yeah.
Okay, right. Harry Potter.
Harry Potter.
I think everyone knew this was coming.
Yeah, there's so many different forms of abuse in Harry Potter.
When I was writing notes, the more I was thinking about it, the more I was thinking, oh my God, this is in there. And that's in there as well. I was like, oh my God, it's like every single book, there's something really terrible. And,
yeah, there's a lot of abuse happening.
And I think the thing is, because the books make you read almost like you would have read as a child, if you'd encountered them like I did as an adult, you don't necessarily think, oh my God, that's abuse, until you stop and think about it. It's a bit like you don't really think, okay, having a child in there one child whose parents were murdered and one child whose parents were tortured into insanity, it's a bit dark for a middle grade children's fiction book. And then you realise, actually, that's exactly what's happened, you know?
It is. I mean, it's not even having one whose parents were murdered. It's having one whose parents were murdered and one was murdered because someone was trying to murder a baby. Like, there is some dark stuff which is happening in Harry Potter. We can't ignore it. Okay, so let's start off with a very obvious abuse, which is the Dursleys' abuse of Harry.
Which is mostly neglect, but I would say there was an emotional and psychological component in there as well.
There is. In the original, apparently in the original manuscripts, there was physical abuse as well, but it was taken out.
Yeah. I suppose they decided it was too much. To be honest, even if you look at it now, even if you look at the first book, which is definitely tamer by the standards of the later books.
Yeah.
You probably would go, actually, this is really bad. He's continually told he's not valued. He's denied everything. He's made to basically slave for his cousin, and he lives under the stairs. He can't even have a bedroom.
Yeah. And I think the other important thing is that he's physically abused by Dudley.
Yeah, nobody does anything about
it. Nobody does anything. In fact, it's not just that nobody does anything. There's a willful ignorance, or a fact that they just don't care, and they're not preventing it. And they could do something about it, but they don't. It's almost encouraged. Dudley is encouraged to look down on Harry. And in that way, the Dursleys, as parents, do get away with physically abusing him through their son, which is kind of an abuse of Dudley as well. Dudley's kind of in a weird position slightly, and I, you know, some would argue that there's kind of an abuse going on there,
because that's what I was about to say.
Yeah, it's a different form of neglect, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there was a push fairly recently for extreme childhood obesity to be considered a form of abuse, because you are overfeeding your child but you're undernourishing them, which is a different form of neglect. And there is an argument to support that, I would agree. But not only do they, you know, basically overfeed Dudley, they're not really providing him with love, support and guidance that he can actually process and use to navigate the world. So when he finally gets to, secondary school, basically, he's so ill-equipped to deal with it that he's almost constantly in trouble. A lot of it happens off page. We don't see much of it. We see the results. We see the enforced dieting and things like that. But a little bit more care and attention earlier on, a little less neglect, and he would have been a different person. And he still somehow manages to overcome a lot of his early conditioning.
He does, but of course, actually, the thing about him is that he overcomes that when he goes away from home. And he grows up to be someone who's a little bit better, but that only really occurs after he's been faced with a trauma which makes him re-examine what Harry is actually like.
Yeah.
After Harry saves him. But then also, he's living away from home and he gets a kind of a separation from his parents, who are kind of enablers.
Definitely.
And that's not what parents are supposed to be. Your parents are not supposed to, you know, you can have a very good relationship with your parents, but they're not your friends. They're your parents, ultimately.
Yeah.
And there needs to be some level of responsibility, which the Dursleys don't give.
No, they don't. And then, I mean, I think the interesting thing you touched on there is the fact that he has to face a trauma. In this case, it's the Dementors in book five.
Yeah.
That Harry actually saves him from. So all that squabbling with his cousin and, you know, the vendetta against him, the permissiveness of his parents for him bullying Harry and making his life miserable. I mean, he actually chases him with four other boys.
Yeah.
All of that suddenly probably seemed quite trivial when he realised just how bad things could get and that he was helpless. And this cousin that he had victimised his entire life had stepped in and saved him. And he didn't have to. He could have just made his escape, couldn't he? Obviously,
yeah.
Harry wouldn't, because that's not Harry's character.
No.
What's interesting is what I think he had there was the realisation that we all have at some point that our parents aren't God and that they're not always right. It's just he had his so much later than Harry did.
Yeah, absolutely. I think also something that's really important to recognise is that we see some of the worst examples of abuse for Harry, not in the first book, but in the second one. And actually, it is also interesting that the Dursleys change the way they treat Harry when they realise they're being watched in the first one. So they get that letter saying for Harry Potter cupboard under the stairs. And they move Harry to a bedroom because they realise that someone is watching and someone knows. And then I just love it because I assume McGonagall is the one writing them or Dumbledore. It's just like, to Harry Potter, smallest bedroom. Privy Drive. like no, we know what you're doing, we can see it, which comes into something else about kind of neglect from Dumbledore and co. But
I think the trouble is it wasn't neglect from Dumbledore, it was very calculatedly done, and I don't think he liked himself for doing it. But
yeah,
the way he
true.
Says, you turned up and you were a little more underfed than I'd like, but you weren't a pampered prince. He didn't want another James Potter at the school. He wanted somebody who'd learned compassion through a bit of suffering, which is awful, but I think is actually what he did.
Yes, but at the same time, I think that there were ways in which he could have done it. I mean, he could have... I mean, I don't know whether Lupin would have been possible, or even to be sent to live with somebody else. Like the Weasleys, or you know what I mean. It isn't. There were other options,
but and, you know,
anyway,
there was also the mother's blood
charm
as well.
Thing. Yeah, exactly. So you know, I understand the reasons behind that. But anyway, we're not going to go into that. But just looking at in the second book, this is also a case of Harry being abused because of his identity and the fact that he's a wizard. And when they find out, you know, they treat him well because they are afraid of his magic. And when they find out that he can't do magic outside of school, they physically lock him up. Like, they put bars on his windows. He's fed through a hole in the door. And he only gets to go to the bathroom twice a day, in which he's accompanied.
Like
he's a prisoner.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he was being starved. They weren't exactly feeding him well.
Yeah, exactly. He was half starved. And he feels like an exhibition. Like he has this nightmare when just before the Weasleys arrive to help him, in which he's in a zoo and people are laughing at him, are tapping at the, you know, he's been made into this exhibition, and nobody and he has no communication with the outside world either. Everything, every part of his identity has been stripped away from him. You know, that's, it's next level of abuse. And again, we say, okay, that's quite cartoonish. But actually, you know, I think it was very important to recognize that that was abuse. And he was in a terrible situation. And there wasn't a hand raised. I think there's this expectation that abuse means physical, and it doesn't.
No.
This was damaging, just as damaging in a very different kind of way.
Yeah, absolutely. Teacher to pupil abuse in Harry Potter.
Yeah. Now, this is why I can never forgive Snape. A lot of people are like, oh, Snape. And I think Snape is a little bit more, in the films, he's better. Like, he's
Yeah,
not
they've made him a
treated.
bit nicer.
They have made him a bit nicer.
Snape did something incredibly brave, but his one redeeming feature was that he never stopped loving Lily, and because of that, he never stopped hating Harry either. I
Yeah.
mean, I've heard some people argue that he loved Harry all along. No, he didn't. He hated him. He hated him, but at the same time, it was the last bit of Lily Potter, therefore he was obliged to look after him.
Yeah, and I like he was perfectly happy for children to be murdered by Voldemort until he found out that Lily might be murdered. He found a picture of Lily, James and Harry, and he ripped it up just so that he could have that part with Lily in it. This is someone who he had an obsessive love, and he couldn't actually be happy for Lily. He wasn't happy for Lily.
No.
And he hated James, and there's a lot to unpackage there. James was not great in school.
No, James was a bully as well.
But actually, the problem is that the only time we ever see James Potter is from Snape's point of view and his worst memory.
Yeah.
And that was definitely an example of James being a total bastard and not very good at all. But the fact that Lily Evans fell in love with him, and the kind of the nice things that everyone else has said, has got to be a testament to the fact that James sorted himself out. Because there's no way that Lily Evans would have ever loved someone who was a bully.
No. And yeah, in fairness, that's the thing, isn't it? Because at some point, most of us have engaged in bullying behaviour to another child, even if that we didn't realise that's what it was. We were too young to understand. We followed the pack or whatever. And it can be something as subtle as joining in with a group of other girls and whispering behind somebody else's back. Or just sitting there and listening and not saying anything while this poor person is character assassinated in front of you.
And that's the thing, is that I just get very annoyed when people are like, oh, James Potter was the worst and Snape was misunderstood. I'm like, no, James Potter definitely did something wrong, but he was attacking, yeah, he did bully Severus Snape, who at that time was the equivalent of a Nazi, was already
Yeah, it was
engaging in
Nazi
that
youth,
kind of,
wasn't it?
he was Nazi youth. Like, it's funny that the same people are like, yeah, Snape was misunderstood. Also, you should punch Nazis whenever you see them. I'm like, you do understand the whole metaphor was that Snape was part of that kind of group and was engaging in that kind of behavior. And that's also, a big reason of why James targeted him and hated him, because he hated everything that Snape stood for. So yeah, James did something very shitty in the way that he treated Snape. But Snape was consistently shitty, and not just to Harry. I think it's really important to recognize that you have a character named Neville Longbottom whose
Yeah.
parents were tortured to insanity, okay? They were tortured to insanity. He has lived his life in some of the scariest circumstances ever. There is some terrifying shit which has happened to Neville Longbottom at school, and yet in third year, his boggart is Severus Snape. No
Yeah.
one should be that afraid of a teacher,
Yeah, I mean,
okay?
he even says, I don't want my grandmother to turn up either. But, Snape is the one who is, it is, as you say, his boggart. And anybody who's ever had a teacher who frightened them that much, and I bet most people have at some point, not necessarily because the teacher has engaged in a lifelong campaign of bullying against them, but just because that teacher shouts a lot, or that teacher doesn't listen to them. That teacher stood them up in front of the entire class and told them off for something. Or that teacher, for something really trivial, for example, spilling a bit of ink on the corner of your French homework, which is
Or
something
that.
that actually happened to me. Sister Damien, the French teacher at the time, it was so bizarre. She gave me a massive compliment in front of the class because my French was very good. And then the next time she went round, she stood me up in front of the class and, you know, basically called me a slattern because I was untidy and I'd got a smudge of ink on the composition. And it made no sense. I could not make those two things fit together. I think I was like 12. But well, it put me off French. Put it that way.
I had a French teacher who used to read out our results. And of course, I was dyslexic. And if you spelt the word wrong, then it was marked as wrong, even if you'd actually got it right. So I would be, it was five questions where you were translating French to English. I'd get all those right. And then it was five translating English to French. And I'd spell things wrong, inevitably.
Yeah.
And I was put in the top class because obviously I was half French. So my speaking French was quite good and my understanding was quite good. And so it meant that everyone else always got full marks. And I always only got 50% because the spelling would render these answers incorrect. And he would read out our results, and he would read mine out and shame me in front of the class every week.
Yeah.
And I just, I was very fortunate in that I had a mother who always backed me up whenever there was injustice. Like, she always believed me if I said something was going on. And she came in, she was there like, so do you know what? She has dyslexia. And my French teacher was like, yes. And he says, do you realise that dyslexia works in other languages as well?
Yeah, I think so too. Okay, moving on from Snape, who was a horrible bully, to Umbridge, who was an out-and-out sadist.
She was an... Umbridge was also terrifying on several levels because she was very controlling as well. And she had to control things, and she created an entire structure, which meant there was only one way of doing things, and it was her way. And of course, that wasn't just the most terrifying thing about her, but it was one of the big qualities about her, which I think is very important.
And it was her campaign of silence as well, which received basically government sanction behind it.
Yeah.
So it's a case of no one is coming to rescue you because we want you to do what she says. We want control of you.
Yeah. And I think that we have here an example of actually a character who's kind of, again, like Miss Trunchbull, but, you know, physically different, but in this sense of there is no consequence for what I do. I can do whatever I want. This position of complete power. And I think that J.K. Rowling was obviously making a very big statement there about the government and about the way that fascism works and how it can kind of operate. And in this case, we have an abuse, not just of children. We have this abuse of a nation. Of all youth, but it starts with children. And it's very kind of reflective of the Hitler Youth, for instance, and the fact that children are targeted and manipulated and arranged to act in a certain way which will benefit adults. Or a few select adults, which results in children, you know, giving up their parents because they're indoctrinated.
Yeah.
And it's a horrific form of abuse. And it really is.
That really is the point where the three of them stop being children in a children's adventure. It's probably characterised best by Hermione, who is the driving force behind Harry taking over teaching the dark arts in secret.
Yeah.
Organising a secret society, secret meetings, punishing Marietta for shopping them all, which is really horrible because she was in a bad position. But Hermione is right in the sense of there is too much at stake now for them to think and act like children about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Hermione, it's interesting in that way because Hermione is brutal. She really is.
She's ruthless, definitely.
She's really, really ruthless. And there's not a lot of compassion there, as you say. She will hand out punishments, she will take matters into her own hands. But Hermione is very much a reflection of the times and what is happening. And I think it was very important to actually show that, because a lot of messages that we give kids is that in the face of adversity, it's better to respond with kindness and gentleness. And some of the things that which were happening in the fifth particular, and the sixth and the seventh book, is that sometimes kindness is not enough. And whilst it's important to be kind to those that matter, when responding to this level of abuse and this level of evil, action is appropriate. And we get that in with Matilda as well. With Matilda, it could have been very much, I know better, so I should try and make an effort to be right. And she didn't. She went, no, I'm going to get even because I do know better.
Yeah.
And it's about saying this is acceptable and that is okay, which I think is also very important, because this narration of be kind, it's only, you know, if you retaliate, you're as bad as them, is also something which can be used to manipulate abuse victims.
It's like, yeah, I agree with that. I'm just going to quickly run through a couple of titles that sort of deal with various types of abuse quite well, because we're running out of time now.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay. And I just want to mention these. I won't go into any detail. One of them is Telling the Sea by Pauline Fisk. And it does something that I haven't yet seen in another mid-grade novel. And the main character, her brother and sister and her mother, all sort of go on the run a bit quietly. And as you get further and further into the story, what you're doing is every time you're sort of following the narrator, who is a sort of 12-year-old girl, she goes down to the sea and she cannot find anybody else to talk to. So it has to go somewhere what she needs to say. So she talks to the sea and starts to develop a morbid fascination with it. And then later on you realise that what she's witnessed is the abuse of her mother by her stepfather. Which again is another form of child abuse, witnessing consistent abuse of another adult by someone who should be a caretaker or caregiver.
Mm.
It kind of does branch into that child abuse thing, because again, if you're wired to think that adults know best, The story does have a happy ending. But you know, if you decide to read it, go in bearing in mind that there is a suicide attempt in there. So. You know, I don't usually do trigger warnings, but I will say, you know, it's quite a hard-hitting one. I would also mention Goodnight, Mr. Tom by Michelle McGorion, which is the most lovely book imaginable. It's about a young evacuee called Willie Beach who goes to live with old Tom Oakley. And as you go into the story, Tom Oakley has been on his own since his wife died. And he's on his own so much he doesn't even realise how lonely he is. And he and this evacuee form a really tight friendship. And then Willie's mother takes him back. And then you realise how horribly he's being abused back in London by his mother. And something really, really awful happens in the middle of all of that as well, which I won't spoil. But it's done in such a lovely way. Not the abuse, but it's done. The entire book is done in such a lovely, heartwarming and yet realistic way. The way he forms a family, basically, with this old man.
Yeah. I think one of the things which really struck me about Goodnight, Mr. Tom, and my first experience of it was actually the movie rather than the book. That was the first time I encountered it, was that there's this very... Mr. Tom is a very brusque, quite a hardy kind of character who's had his own loss. And he doesn't, you know, he's very stern and strict, and it's very different. And for a child who's been abused, he's terrifying, because you know Willie is expecting to be abused by Mr. Tom as well, to the point that Mr. Tom is unpackaging the things that Willie's been given, and there's a letter from the mother just saying, I've put the belt in there as well, please use it whenever you need to.
Yeah.
And Mr. Tom's like, oh my god. And then there's a one bit where Willy gets totally terrified, which is, I think, was quite a good reflection of actually what happened to a lot of these city kids. They went to the country and they'd never encountered certain animals before, and they were
like
terrified
cows.
Of them, like cows. And he encounters Mr. Tom's dog, and he's terrified of it. He thinks it's going to attack him. So he starts waving a stick at it, and Mr. Tom comes out saying, "What are you doing?" You know. And he brings Willy in to tell him off, and he's stoking the fire as he's doing it, and he raises the fire poker to kind of to wave at him.
Yeah.
And the way they frame it, you just see Willy just stare at this fire poker, and then he passes out. He faints because he thinks, right, that's what I'm about to be hit with. And Mr. Tom has this moment of what? And then he looks at the fire poker and he goes, no, he couldn't have thought.
Yeah.
And I just thought that was such a brilliant way of framing the level of abuse that Willy had gone through without ever having to physically show it at all.
Yeah.
Just to show the response, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, it does it really well. And a last one I would briefly mention, because we really are short of time now, is The Tulip Touch by Anne Fine, which is quite a gripping and disturbing read. I'd say go and try it, but I think it shows peer abuse really well, and behind peer abuse is the reason for the peer abuse, which again I won't go into. But it starts off as a friendship and a fascination, and gradually one person manipulates the other more and more and more until it basically becomes an abusive relationship.
Yeah. It's a very good example of actually how abuse can be learned, and how neglect can how some forms of abuse such as neglect can therefore materialize into, you know, the neglected victim becoming physically abusive as a response to other people, because there's this kind of this power play, there's a need for a sense of power, for a sense of appreciation, for a sense of worship even. And The Tulip Touch does that very well, and it really actually kind of highlights what can happen to young kids when put in these positions, and actually how young kids can also be abusive to one another in these abusive relationships. So yeah, sorry. This is a big one. This was a big.
It's a
topic.
Much bigger topic than even not delving into it as deeply as we possibly could have done.
Yeah.
So we're going to draw a line under it there and go on to our recommendation of the week.
Yeah. And Jules, I believe that you have a recommendation this week.
Yeah. It's a young adult book, so we're moving completely away from middle grade, and it is part two of a duology. I would say read both books. So read Strange the Dreamer by Lainey Taylor, and then read Muse of Nightmares, which is also by Lainey Taylor, strangely enough.
It's what?
Yeah, I know. So, well, you know, it could have been written by somebody else. They have started an experiment. Anyway, it's this amazing lyrical fantasy that deals with so many themes that I literally haven't got time to go into right now. But it's amazing. It's beautifully written. It's so clever, and what it looks at ultimately is the transformative power of forgiveness, both for yourself and for other people, and how stopping the cycle is a healthier way for everybody to move forward and heal. But there's a lot of action in there before that. The only thing I would say is the first book can seem a little bit slow, but it's well worth it. It all builds up to everything in the second book, so you do kind of need to read both books together.
Yeah. Okay, brilliant.
Right.
Well, thanks very much for listening, guys, and we'll catch you next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.